information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight we care.
Here to border
and it shows.
The law.
The country.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Being lied to by
the government of believe they were innocent. They have no idea what they're up against.
I don't think there's much to this story. I don't believe that I was brainwashed. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 208 from Media Monarchy. It's March 4th, 2011, and my name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. This week, Nightmarica, PSYOPs, Brainwash, and the Intel Hub, food prices, space planes, and a national state of emergency, genetic pat-downs, human testing, and the last vet standing, plus winning the InfoWar, Sheen, and so much more. All here, March 4th, 2011, episode 208, and this is MediaMonarchy.com.
Thank you.
Nightmarica. It's a date. It's a commandment. It's a band. The March 4th Marching Band, Portland, Oregon's own. That's from their Rise Up album from 2009, Nightmarica. And of course, today is the name for which they are named. Playing tonight at the Crystal Ballroom here in Portland, Oregon, where I am coming to you live. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. This is episode 208, and it is March 4th, 2011. And we are broadcasting live, as always, live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. Since October 2006, live every Friday. We have hundreds of episodes and B-sides, as well as musical mixtapes, interviews, so much more. Huge thanks to the stations that help syndicate Media Monarchy, and especially those that broadcast the show live as we speak, ZeroPointRadio.com. Huge thanks to those guys. They also blasted out terrestrially in Casper, Wyoming, 92.3 FM and 1670 AM. Huge thanks. And of course, the worldwide home of free speech, RevereRadio.net in Florida. And all the others, you know who you are. They're linked up. They are thanked. It's all on MediaMonarchy.com. Of course, thanks to TragedyAndHope.com for spreading the word and helping further all of our growth and connections and community and all those things. The social network, we're on them all. Friend Face, Jitter, they're all linked up again, top right of the page. If you don't want to miss a thing, subscribe to feeds.feedburner.com/Media Monarchy. You get the audio, the video, the articles, the PDFs, everything through the feed. That's on the top right of the page. Of course, radioforall.net, archive.org. You can get all those through iTunes. Radio for All is the lower quality audio only, but the aforementioned feeds.feedburner.com/Media Monarchy is your everything feed. Also on the top right of the page is the donate button. And yes, now it's been 1 year since our Money March last year, which we launched again with the help of the TragedyAndHope.com community. We had a fundraiser, and we had exclusive copies of 2020 Hindsight Censorship on the front line. If you donate $10 or more, that as well as the latest issue of Rock Creek Free Press and any other little goodies I can shove in a small little mailer and send out to you. So your donations help keep the site and show and everything growing and going. We do have a P.O. Box. P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon, 97212. And again, your donations help pay for the DJ dues here at the station, keeping things running, keeping things smooth. And again, all of these outlets are pretty much only able to survive because of your support. That goes for myself, and that goes for PRA, that goes for Zero Point Radio, that goes for Revere Radio, Tragedy and Hope. All these sites need your help. So huge thanks to Jeff in California and, yet again, my man Sam in Belgium for their recent donations. So again, folks, all that is up on the top right of the page. And we glance, as we always do, at the breaking news on the front of Don't Be Evil. U.S. unemployment falls and the market's reaction. We also have the Atlantic asking, how many Americans really want jobs? Mideast protest at a glance. And in Florida, police searching home of suspect in canal deaths. And of course, there's all the other trending stories about iPad 2 and Johnny Depp and Gaddafi and God knows what else. But my friends, we're here and it's now. And I thank you for joining. Wherever you are in the world, welcome. The first thing I'll mention, as I'm looking at it right now, I was able to turn on... you don't know how that sentence is going to end. Blogger, the way I do all my blogs. Set up a freebie through Blogspot and then just buy the .com and tell it to point to that. Keep the cost down, and of course Google has huge amounts of hosting, and generally they are never down. So we're dancing with the devil. In many ways, we are in all of these waters that we swim in. But I was able to turn on the mobile versions of the blogs. So if you go on your little smarty phone and you bring up MediaMonarchy.com or CyberspaceWar.com, HolyHexes.com, and FoodWorldOrder.com, you should see the mobile version, which pretty much strips away all of the extra stuff, just gives you the posts. And it's nice and clean and loads pretty quickly and easily. So I don't have those linked up on those blogs. You'd have to do it through your phone to find them. Or just add ?M=1 after any URL, and that'll turn it into the mobile version. So that's kind of nice, and I'm kind of digging that. So again, that is a nice thing that I don't have to try and farm out and get somebody to do or bang my head against it and try and figure it out through trial and error. So, yet again, thanks, Google. But the first thing I want to mention is I was lucky enough to go on the Intel Hub radio show this past Wednesday on Oracle Broadcasting, theintelhub.com. And what was great is that I was able to go on with my man Paul Verge of DivergentFilms.com, one of the great members and producers in the TragedyAndHope.com community. And I went ahead and added that MP3, the entire show. So again, if you subscribe to the feed, you've already gotten that. Fortunately, I think Paul of the aforementioned Divergent Films, the man behind 2020 Hindsight, Hijacking Humanity, and the upcoming Believers Beware, I believe he's putting together a video version of that conversation. And if you've checked out any of the latest things from CorbettReport.com or from Richard Grove and Tragedy and Hope, just the videos and the things that they're able to put together constantly blow me away. The joke I made on that recording, if you listen to it, you can hear it, is that, you know, the saying is you should surround yourself with people smarter than you. And I think I have done that with resounding success by being fortunate enough to be hooked up with all of these folks. Because their game makes me step it up, and we all kind of keep and grow and react and learn and bounce everything off each other and share it all out with you guys. Again, it's not really like, oh, we're us, and it's all totally accessible. You can get a hold of me, MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. I will most likely contact you back, maybe not immediately. And again, we're all kind of one-man bands, or lone wolves, as they'd like to refer to us. But needless to say, I believe there's going to be a video version of myself and Paul's appearance on the IntelHub.com. So more on that, and of course, watch that space when it comes out. And if you subscribe to the feeds, you will get it. The latest episode that I have posted up from PeaceRevolution.org, the amazing educational podcast from Richard Grove. Episode 18 is A History of the World in Our Time, getting into the book, which gives its name to what we've been talking about, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by, of course, Professor Carol Quigley. There are other books and YouTube videos and playlists and things leaked up to do more research on this. Also, a great video with Rich and Maria, M-E-R-I-A.net, discussing secret societies. And that's also a little bit of a test and a sneak preview for the upcoming second episode of What You've Been Missing. So many amazing things, and I don't even have posted up yet, but episode 19 of Peace Revolution is, I believe, in part, myself and Paul on the Intel Hub. Latest episodes from CorbettReport.com, episode 177. It's the sun, stupid. We know that the man-made global warming hoax is just that, and a scam. But if it isn't CO2 driving the climate, what is? This episode talks to Dr. Tim Ball and examines the work of Piers Corbin, exploring the ways in which the sun affects the climate on Earth and what that means for our future. And as we have discussed all throughout recent episodes, and especially over on cyberspacewar.com, the coming Solar Max 2012. The latest Sunday update, false flags unraveling, another knock it out of the park Sunday update. And James had another appearance on the InfoWars show with Aaron Dykes discussing Middle East protest and the grand chessboard. That is also up in video version. Of course, latest interviews, the aforementioned Tim Ball and also Aidan Monahan on his amazing work on the events of 9/11 and all of his FOIA investigations. And of course, In the Zone with Eric Schein. So much media. I know some folks complain sometimes, especially if I make these into YouTube videos. It's, oh, I don't want to listen to all these plugs. Well, you don't have to. But I wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for the folks that we're discussing. So there. Latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com, episode 65, Experiments Exposed, Cloning Closed, and Conspiracy Shows. Stories 1, 2, and 3, Past Medical Testing on Humans Revealed. We will discuss that on this very episode. Major Farm Animal Cloning Project Canceled Due to Death and Disease. We will discuss that on an upcoming B-side episode where we're going to go over most of the other alternative media from Holy Hexes and Cyberspace War and Food World Order. And the third story, Ideas for a TV Show About Conspiracy Theories. Unfortunately, if you have watched the entirety of that latest episode 65 from NewWorldNextWeek.com, you will know that, sadly, my man James has had a death in the family, so needless to say, he's going to be taking a hiatus pretty much through the month of March, and we all send him our prayers and hopes and support, and I'm sure everybody out there would offer anything that he may need out of us, and it may not be anything at all, but just to put that out there. And again, I can sympathize, but I cannot empathize, and he must be going through a lot. So needless to say, my friends, your support in so many ways is important. So even though we talked about it so much at the beginning, you know, financially is the very small part of it. The one and only Clyde Lewis of GroundZeroMedia.org, he's someone else that when I post his articles, and I always post up his weekly radio shows, which get podcasted out, and all those links are provided for you. He's also got GroundZeroTV.org, run by the madman Mohawk Mike. He's got a great video on the Portland Says No to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And we're going to hit that again in an upcoming episode as the decision is looming whether Portland's going to join and rejoin the Joint Terrorism Task Force. But I digress. Uber Alice, Battle of Los Angeles. Sometimes films can spark interest in things that we have forgotten. We can see them as art that reflects what has happened in the past. In some cases, movies can be seen as predictive programming that can approximate a future out of many possible futures. When reality imitates movie sci-fi, the storyline can no longer be a reflection or an imitation of life. It's shaped the way we live and how we perceive our reality. Movies have been great prognosticators and have become a blueprint for what is to come in the future. Using history as its inspiration, movies can give us syntax and a lens through which reality is being force-structured, a medium of predictive programming that may become a conditioned gospel for some. Of course, he's discussing the new movie coming out next Friday, 311, Battle Los Angeles, and we will discuss that more on episode 209 next week. But needless to say, great guests on this episode, and it's all available for you. John Horrigan and some of his photos and information. And the update is actually next week's guest has been announced. He's going to have Michael Rupert, the one and only author of Crossing the Rubicon, of course, from the Wilderness newsletter and website. And, of course, the scariest film of 2009, Collapse, which is, I believe, available for instant watch. And I'll mention again, coming soon, one of these days, so many projects that we want to get together for you, NavigatingNetflix.com. So, Michael Rupert is going to be on Ground Zero this coming Sunday, March 6th. And again, you can listen live, you can hit the links. It's on KUFO 101.1 FM here in Portland, Oregon, but you can get the links off of groundzeromedia.org. My man Alan, one of the main editors over on cyberspacewar.com, also posted something about this Battle of Los Angeles special where he also mentions, of course, John Horrigan, but also Matt Haley was a guest, and he is a comic book artist and directed and produced a spoof of Star Wars called Black Star Warrior, kind of a blaxploitation trailer for a film about Lando Calrissian as the star and Han Solo as his sidekick, and it's amazingly well done. I recommend you watch that. And that leads into Matt, of course, the comic book artist, who's going to be in Seattle, Washington this weekend at the Pacific Northwest's biggest comic book convention, Emerald City Comic Con. I won't be going to that, but that segues into the one thing we want to hit on this episode from my latest site in the kingdom, holyhexes.com. And a quick post about the possible forthcoming Preacher film. Will it be a godsend or a blasphemy? This from Reuters. Director DJ Caruso, whose new movie, I Am Number 4, again, speaking of predictive programming. Director DJ Caruso, whose new movie, I Am Number 4, claimed the number 3 spot at the holiday weekend box office, has closed a deal to shoot the comic book adaptation Preacher. The popular 1990s DC Vertigo comic book series told the story of a down-and-out Texas preacher possessed by Genesis, a supernatural entity conceived by the unnatural coupling of an angel and a demon. Given immense powers, the preacher teamed with an old girlfriend and a hard-drinking Irish vampire and set out on a journey across America to find God, who apparently had abandoned his duties in heaven, and hold him accountable for his negligence. Created by Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon, Preacher ran from 95 to the year 2000. Sam Mendes of American Beauty and Road to Perdition fame was previously attached to direct the Columbia adaptation, but he left for the new James Bond film. Darren Aronofsky, of course, of Pi, Requiem, Wrestler, Fountain, Black Swan, he flirted with the project at one point, but now, supposedly, this guy, DJ Caruso, is going to do it. His other credits include Eagle Eye and Disturbia. I have to say, I was a big Vertigo comic nerd in high school, and Preacher, as well as The Invisibles, and Sandman and Sandman Mystery Theater, some of my favorite comics. So as much as I would like to see some of those favorite books from my teenage years get turned into a movie, it's probably going to be a terrible disaster. And I would have to agree, as some folks have said, they should go the HBO series route. That would be one way it could be done quality, or if it even was as decent as The Walking Dead, I suppose. And yes, we did just have the 83rd Academy Awards this past Sunday, and we will make some references to that further on through this episode 208. We want to glance also at cyberspacewar.com for something that's happening today. And again, as I said, most of the other coverage on cyberspacewar.com we're going to go over on the B-side to this episode coming up. But the second U.S. secret space warplane, the X-37B, to launch today in just a mere few hours. Taking it from theregister.co.uk, the U.S. Air Force is set to launch its second X-37B miniature unmanned space plane, the type famously dubbed a secret space warplane by the Iranian government, on Friday, today, March 4th, 2011. The United States Air Force Rapid Capabilities Office, which oversees the X-37B program, says that the second Orbital Test Vehicle Mission, OTV-2, will lift off from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station atop an Atlas V rocket, just as the preceding OTV-1 mission did, and will deploy the second of two X-37B space planes currently owned by the Air Force. The launch window will open at 3:39 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Once in orbit, the X-37B deploys a solar panel array, unlike its bigger cousin, the Space Shuttle, which uses fuel cells for electrical power. Thus, the little robot space plane can remain in orbit for much longer periods, unsupported, before re-entering the atmosphere to make a runway landing. The previous OTV-1 mission, carrying a payload which remained secret, lasted 224 days and ended with a successful landing at the Vandenberg Military Space Base in California. As yet, the United States Air Force has not revealed the planned duration of the OTV-2 mission launching today. And again, details of the payload are not being revealed. Secret space plane heading back into orbit. We have further reading from the Tehran Times and Danger Room, and straight from the horse's mouth, and links to the Air Force's Rapid Capability Office. And the flashback to April of 2010, Air Force space plane, military launching robotic space vehicle. So expect to see more updates on the growing space war on cyberspacewar.com. I suppose you would ask, why is everything escalating? Because it would seem that everything is falling apart on Earth, so perhaps they're looking at other planets. They're looking at Alternative 3 to get off this rock, perhaps. I'm sure that's just one of the areas of possibility. And, of course, they couldn't really be doing that, but I saw it in a make-believe movie once. So if we're trying to get off of this rock because we're doomed, as they want us to all believe, and of course as every sect and religion and cult and movement and group has their own end-time apocalyptic scenario that's bearing down on us, whether it's the Son of God or the sun in the sky, the price of food is at the heart of this wave of revolutions, is at the heart of what's going on. No one saw the uprisings coming, but their deeper cause isn't hard to fathom. This coming from independent.co.uk, Peter Popham writing, going back to this past Sunday, February 27th. Revolution is breaking out all over. As Gaddafi marshals his thugs and mercenaries for a last-ditch fight in Tripoli, several died as protests grew more serious in Iraq. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah tried to bribe his people into docility by splashing out $35 billion on housing, social services, and education. Across the water in Bahrain, the release of political prisoners failed to staunch the uprising. In Iran, President Ahmadinejad crowed about chaos in the Arab world, but said nothing about the seething anger in his own backyard. In Yemen, the opposition gathers strength daily, and it's not just the Middle East. This is an African crisis. Tunisia, where it started, is an African country, and last week, Senegal, a desperate army veteran, died after setting fire to himself in front of the presidential palace, emulating Mohamed Bouazizi, the market trader whose self-immolation sparked the revolution in Tunisia. Meanwhile, the spirit of revolt has already leapt in like a forest fire to half a dozen other ill-governed African nations, with serious disturbances reported in Maranita, Gabon, Cameroon, and Zimbabwe. Nowhere is immune. Dozens of activists in China are in detention or under other forms of surveillance, and the LinkedIn network was shut down as authorities seek to stamp out Middle East-style protests there. In what is arguably the most repressive state on the planet, North Korea, the army was called out and five dead in the northern city of Sinuiju after violent protests erupted there and in two other cities. The generals who rule Burma under a trashy facade of constitutional government were keeping a close eye on the Middle East, ready to lock up Aung San Suu Kyi again at the first sign of copycat disturbances. Nowhere is immune to this wave of rebellion because globalization is a fact. All the world's markets are intricately interlinked, and woe in one place quickly translates into fury in another. 20 years ago, things were more manageable. When grain production collapsed in the Soviet Union during the 1980s and what had been one of the world's greatest grain exporters became a net importer, the resulting surges of anger brought down the whole communist system within a couple of years. But stop there. Today, there are no such fire breaks, and thanks to digital communications, events happen much faster. Why are all these revolutions happening now? Plenty of answers have been offered. The emergence of huge urban populations with college degrees but no prospect of work. The accumulation of decades of resentment at rulers who are authoritarian familial kleptocracies delivering little to their people, as Peter Bergen of the New American Foundation put it, the subversive role of Facebook and Twitter fatally undermining the state system of thought control. Absent from this list, to the combined bewilderment and relief of the U.S. and Europe, are the factors that were universally supposed to be driving populist politics in the Middle East. Islamic fundamentalism, coupled with anti-Zionism and anti-Americanism. As one Egyptian pointed out after the fall of Mubarak, at no point during weeks of passionate revolt did either the Israeli or the U.S. embassies become a target of the crowd's fury, even though both are within easy reach of Tahrir Square. Not so much as a Coke can was thrown over the wall, he said. Of course, that doesn't mean the allies of Al-Qaeda will not seek to exploit the growing chaos in Libya in particular, striving to turn it into a new Somalia Sirmed. Nor does it guarantee that any of the other revolts will produce stable democracies, because the real cause of these revolutions, beyond all the chatter about social networks, is a problem that's liable to get worse in coming years rather than better, and that is largely beyond the power of anyone to contain or control. The first warnings of what was to come appeared in the form of a briefing paper on the website of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in December. Recent bouts of extreme price volatility in global agricultural markets portend rising and more frequent threats to world food security. There is emerging consensus that the global food system is becoming more vulnerable and susceptible to episodes of extreme price volatility. As markets are increasingly integrated in the world economy, shocks in the international arena can now transpire and propagate to domestic markets much quicker than before. Food World Order. The photo with the story shows protesters with bread in their hands with the words "leave" written into it and baked into it. The price of food is at the heart of this wave of revolutions. And don't believe for a second that somehow we can't grow enough food. The world could be fed a million times over if they wanted it to, but that's not part of the agenda. That's not a part of the eugenics agenda, which so many of the issues that we discuss go back to. So, my friends, for all the other media we're going to cover, like I said, on the upcoming episode 208B, where we'll get the rest of food prices and food riots and more, as well as all the latest from Holy Hexes and Cyberspace War. And I'm sure there were other things I wanted to add as I was going through that piece from The Independent, making notes in my head, but now that it's done, I don't have them. For the remainder of this episode, we're going to go to the flagship site, MediaMonarchy.com. Obama declares national state of emergency over Libya. We're going to take the article from foreignpolicy.com. But we'll start it with a question from endoftheamericandream.com. Is Obama about to order the military to invade Libya? President Obama issued an executive order last Friday that imposes immediate sanctions on Libyan ruler Muammar al-Qaddafi, his sons, and his accomplices in the slaughter of civilians. In a letter accompanying the order, Obama declared a national emergency over the situation. Quote, I have determined that the actions of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, his government, and close associates, including extreme measures against the people of Libya, constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States. The order declares a national emergency to deal with this threat, end quote. Obama wrote in the letter to House Speaker John Bonner, Republican of Ohio. Earlier Friday, new White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said that the more punitive measures against the Gaddafi regime were on the way. Quote, the steps we take in the near future are not the only steps we are prepared to take if further steps are necessary, Carney said. Possible steps include a no-fly zone over Libya, as has been advocated by senators, Washington experts, and over 200 Arab organizations. The last members of the U.S. Embassy staff in Libya were evacuated last Friday, and the embassy building was shuttered, although the Obama administration still has not broken off relations with the Gaddafi regime or publicly called for Gaddafi to step down. The flag is still flying, the embassy is not closed, but operations are suspended, said Under Secretary of State for Management Patrick Kennedy. We did not break diplomatic relations. There's no word yet on how the sanctions will affect the $100 million investment by al-Sadi Gaddafi, one of the sons, in a film company that's producing a movie entitled The Iceman, Confessions of a Mafia Contract Killer, starring Mickey Rourke. The intersection of entertainment and politics in the media, military, industrial, infotainment complex are replete. And of course, there are so many more updates to this story, and we have things from VOA News. We have the executive orders and letters linked up for you. You can get them as PDFs on Scribd. And you can read more about the Iceman and the $100 million investment. But posted below this story, we have all our other related geopolitical updates. And an article from David Rothscum. David Rothscum reports, world cheers as the Central Intelligence Agency plunges Libya into chaos. How is Libya doing under the rule of Gaddafi? How bad did the people have it? Were they as oppressed as we now commonly accept as fact? Before the chaos erupted, check this out, and all the links are there. Libya had a lower incarceration rate than the Czech Republic. It ranked 61st. Libya had the lowest infant mortality rate of all of Africa. Libya had the highest life expectancy of all of Africa. Less than 5% of the population was undernourished. In response to the rising food prices around the world, the government of Libya abolished all taxes on food. With a link to Reuters for that. People in Libya were rich. Libya had the highest gross domestic product GDP and purchasing power parity per capita of all of Africa. The government took care to ensure that everyone in the country shared in the wealth. Libya had the highest human development index of any country on the continent. The wealth was distributed equally. In Libya, a lower percentage of people live below the poverty line than in the Netherlands. How did Libya get so rich? The answer is oil. The country has a lot of oil and does not allow foreign corporations to steal the resources while the population starves, unlike countries like Nigeria, a country that is essentially run by Shell. Like any country, Libya suffers from a government... Libya suffers from a government with corrupt bureaucrats that try to gain a bigger portion of the pie at the cost of everyone else. In response to this, Gaddafi called for the oil revenue to be distributed directly to the people because, in his opinion, the government was failing the people. With a link to the Deutsche Press Agency for that. However, unlike the article claims, Gaddafi is not the president of Libya. In fact, he holds no official position in the government. This is the big mistake that people make. They claim that Gaddafi rules over Libya when, in fact, he doesn't. His position is more or less ceremonial. He should be compared to a founding father. The true leader of Libya is an indirectly elected prime minister. The current prime minister is Baghdadi Mahmoudi. Calling Gaddafi the leader of Libya is comparable to calling Akihito the leader of Japan. Contrary to what your media is sketching, opinions in Libya vary. Some people support Gaddafi, but want Mahmoudi out. Others want both out. Many just want to live their life in peace. And can't that be said about all of us? The 99% of us. But unfortunately, we're all tricked into hating each other and fighting each other with various levels of ham-fisted to 21st century stealth sophisticated propaganda. So again, that's from David Roscomb Reports, and we'll blast down the other related geopolitical updates, and you'll start to see what this is about if you haven't already figured it out. Gaddafi's son's friendship with oddball banker Nat Rothschild is remarkable, says the Daily Mail. Libyan flags flew over here in the People's Republic of Portland in a protest calling for the end of the regime. That's from Examiner. Again, liberal towns are easily whipped into a frenzy while things fall apart in your own backyard. But needless to say, the real truth about the Mideast takeover, that's from naturalmedicine.com. U.S. repositioning forces around Libya, that's from Reuters. Wall Street Journal reporting Libyans march west as battle lines harden. U.S. has, of course, sent at least two warships and at least 1,200 Marines. Webster Tarpley on Tarpley.net getting into the U.S. and U.K. imperialist rampage enveloping Libya in civil war with help from Al-Qaeda. And again, Daily Mail reporting on Gaddafi's support by Blair cronies, ex-MI6 chiefs, and the London School of Economics, and referring to many of those as useful idiots. That's how Gaddafi gets some support. And something I missed as we now go around the globe and get all the other geopolitical situations is the story about freed Google executive says he helped spark Egypt revolt. We take the story from theglobeandmail.com, and yes, that's now a couple of weeks old, but listening to some radio show or podcast reminded me that I don't think I ever really mentioned it on this show, but isn't it interesting that someone connected to Google had something intricately to do with the supposed spontaneous uprising in Egypt that we saw. Anti-government protests continue in Croatia. That's from setimes.com. Oil rises as Mideast turmoil spreads to Oman. That's from businessweek.com. Yemeni president says U.S. real behind the unrest. And the arrest of Raymond Davis throws U.S. undercover campaign in Pakistan into disarray. And I believe there's another article kind of comparing the treatment of Raymond Davis, the accused murderous CIA contractor in Pakistan, murdered too. His two compadres were spirited away, never to be seen again. Compare that with someone like Assange, or better yet, Bradley Manning. Now, BusinessInsider.com reporting, and we've got the clip from someone that's going to be at the heart of this matter, Russia Today, where the one and only Hillary says what we have all known. Business Insider says, Hillary says, Al Jazeera is putting U.S. media to shame. However, breaking it more to the point, redacted news, Hillary asks for cash as the U.S. is losing the info war.
The U.S. is losing an information war to alternative media outlets, including RT. That's the message from Hillary Clinton to Congress members who are questioning the State Department's $47 billion budget request for next year. And as RT's Ghani Chichikian reports, the U.S. Secretary of State says Washington needs to step up its propaganda efforts.
Hillary Clinton was defending her department budget in Congress. She says a major reason the State Department needs money is because the U.S. is losing the information war. And among those media who are winning that war, Hillary Clinton named RT.
I'll be very blunt in my assessment. Al Jazeera is winning. The Chinese have opened up a global English language and multi-language television network. The Russians have opened up an English language network. I've seen it in a few countries, and it's quite instructive.
Mrs. Clinton says she's leading an effort to spread U.S. propaganda through new media, with Twitter feeds in Arabic and Farsi. But on global stage, the U.S. trails when it comes to television. She basically said the U.S. should step up propaganda efforts and get back, quote, in the game of doing, quote, what we do best. Here's more.
During the Cold War, we did a great job in getting America's message out. After the Berlin Wall fell, we said, okay, fine, enough of that. You know, we've done it. We're done. And unfortunately, we are paying a big price for it. And our private media cannot fill that gap. In fact, our private media, particularly cultural programming, often works at counter purposes to what we truly are as Americans and what our values are. I remember having an Afghan general tell me that the only thing he thought about Americans is that all the men wrestled and the women walked around in bikinis, because the only TV he ever saw was Baywatch and Worldwide Wrestling.
Some 5 years ago, Western media outlets, including BBC and CNN, basically had a monopoly in the coverage of world news. Things have changed a lot since then. More and more viewers across the world tune into various foreign media to get a fresh take on the events. RT presence on YouTube, for example, is a real hit, almost 300 million views. CNN has something like 3 million. Al Jazeera's coverage of the unrest in the Middle East and in North Africa has outdone the U.S. presentation of the events. While many are happy to see this emerging media variety, the head of a U.S. agency that manages the country's government-run international broadcasting has basically called those foreign media enemies. This Wednesday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton basically confirmed it, saying that the U.S. is at war, at an information war with foreign media.
Now, the U.S. is being left behind in the global media race because the country isn't committed to freedom of speech. That's according to investigative journalist Danny Schechter.
The United States feels on the defensive, in part because it can no longer monopolize not only the terms of authority in these countries, but also the terms of the debate. There's other information out there. There are other points of view. And those points of view are profoundly damaging to a country that believes that its point of view is the only point of view, or should be the only point of view. So Hillary Clinton one day is defending the internet, the next day the administration is proposing all kinds of regulations and ways to cut off the internet if possible. There's no real commitment to the kind of freedom of diverse speech that we really need if we're going to be in a democracy at home and in a community of nations overseas. We can't dictate what people believe anymore.
And that's where the independent, non-commercial, non-corporate alternative media is filling the gap. And you know, we've been covering and playing clips and taking bits from Russia Today and Al Jazeera and Press TV and some of those other outlets on Media Monarchy from the very beginning. And, of course, you heard her say it. Winning! Al Jazeera is winning. So to have someone like Hillary just come right out and say we're losing the info war is great ammo for the rest of us to fire right back. So let's keep going. The rest of our geopolitical updates are brutal, and there are clips to go along with it, too. An update on last week. Illegal PSYOP, neither illegal nor PSYOP, General's lawyer ruled, but we'll take it from McCain and Lieberman and their take that the PSYOP report was weird.
There was an article in Rolling Stone, not sure if that's among your reading material while you travel through the Middle East, but and it said in it that a three-star general in Afghanistan who was in charge of training Afghan forces asked information operations in the U.S. military to gather information about visiting senators, visiting dignitaries, in order to better persuade them, to kind of get into your minds, get into your background, to try to persuade you for more money. Indeed, the money was forthcoming, but the idea was that you and Senator Lieberman, in fact, were both mentioned specifically as people who were targeted by information operations. What do you make of that story? Are you offended by it? And did you feel any undue pressure or any kind of information operations going on when you were over there?
Actually, I'm sure that they succeeded with Senator Lieberman. There's no doubt about that. There's an investigation of that. My positions were well known on the issue of troops in Afghanistan and the situation there. But I'd also like to say General Caldwell has done a magnificent job in training the Afghan army. He is a superb leader. And the job that he has done, I think, will allow us to hand over the responsibilities to the Afghan military. He's a great general.
Senator Lieberman, you've been over there many times in Afghanistan. What do you make of the idea of using information operations for something like that to help persuade you all to back the training of Afghan forces and other things?
Well, it's a weird story, honestly. General Petraeus has said he's going to investigate it. I'm glad he's going to. General Caldwell, who's a general involved, has really done a great job in Afghanistan. And, of course, he, through his spokesman, has totally denied it. I remember the briefings from General Caldwell's staff, and really they were very uneventful. And the truth is that before John and I ever got to that level of briefing, we were supporting the training of the Afghan military, because the sooner the Afghan military can defend Afghanistan, the sooner we will bring out most of the American troops that are there now. So I don't think there's much to this story. I don't, contrary to what Senator McCain has said about my state of mind, I don't believe that I was brainwashed.
Could I finally, these people obviously, Candy, these people are given information about us and obviously our positions and what issues and what areas that we would want addressed. I think that's natural, but we'll wait and see what the investigation shows.
And there you have it. I don't think there's much to this story. I don't believe that I was brainwashed. All they did was ask me to pass the time by playing a game of solitaire. Furthermore, in the geopolitical war horror from allgov.com, defense agency awarded contract to director's father's country. The new head of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, Regina Dugan, who was appointed July 20th, 2009 by the Obama Sia, made sure that her daddy's company, Red X Defense, got a sweet $400,000-plus contract. Isn't that nice and cushy? Meanwhile, Boeing lands a huge tanker deal themselves.
It is a huge contract, even by Pentagon standards. $35 billion for Boeing to build the Air Force's next generation of flying gas stations. Chicago-based Boeing pulled off a surprise in landing a deal to build nearly 200 air refueling planes and beating its only rival, European Aeronautic Defense and Space Company.
I think what we can tell you is Boeing was a clear winner.
The new tankers will begin replacing the aging fleet the Pentagon's been using since the Eisenhower administration.
It's literally the oldest large fleet of jets in the world. Without them, we can't get to places like Afghanistan, but we don't know how much longer they can safely be flown.
The Pentagon had been trying to replace them for years, but kept stumbling during the contract process.
We will get about delivering a capability that's long overdue, and we'll stop talking about it.
Boeing has said the deal will create some 50,000 jobs in dozens of states, including at a major plant about 30 miles north of Seattle.
I worked on this plane for 15 years. That they are getting their money's worth. It's a great airplane. and it's well-built and designed.
They're jobs that now will not be coming to Mobile, Alabama, where EADS was going to set up shop at an abandoned military base.
It's just very difficult to lose when you work so hard, as all the people have on this project.
We thought we were perfectly qualified to win at this time, since EADS has already built the plane, already flying the plane, already has it tested, and Boeing's plane is still on paper. We thought we were in good shape for the competition.
There may be more to come, though. The $35 billion could end up being just the first installment on a $100 billion deal if the Air Force decides to buy more tankers. Sagar Meghani, The Associated Press, Washington.
Now, isn't it interesting? They say they were already building it and flying it and testing it in Alabama, but lo and behold, out of nowhere, Chicagoland gets the deal. And, of course, you know, we've discussed Chicago quite recently and their acquisition, or rather being acquisitioned by, the Mossad Mayor Rahmbo Emanuel. New York Times reports on the children it's killed with your tax money. Gathering firewood, nine boys aged 9 to 15 years old, killed by NATO helicopters who mistook them for insurgents, according to the statement made by NATO this past Wednesday, which apologized for the mistake. And Danger Room also reports that the top general apologizes for the deaths of these nine Afghan kids in kind of an unusual move, and that video is there on Danger Room. But our final note of geopolitical updates posted below the Obama calls national state of emergency over Libya is a report from the National Geographic. Small nuclear war could reverse global warming for years. Regional war could spark unprecedented climate change, experts predict. Even a regional nuclear war could spark unprecedented global cooling and reduce rainfall for years, according to U.S. government computer models. However, widespread famine and disease would likely follow. Is that part of the insane Dr. Strangelovian eugenics agenda? Furthermore, on MediaMonarchy.com, DNA genetic pat-down introduced to airports by the Department of Homeland Stupidity. This from ActivistPost.com, and all our other police state international updates will follow, but reading, a new level. But we're always reaching new levels. A new level of invasive screening is scheduled for airports this summer. A portable DNA scanner to conduct on-site real-time genetic testing. This technology is being implemented under the cover of combating human trafficking, illegal immigration, and finding missing persons. But Richard Selden of NetBio, creator of the scanners, clearly states that, quote, DNA information has the potential to become a part of the fabric of day-to-day life. In an interview with Katie Drummond, who broke the story for TheDaily.com, Selden envisions additional applications in emergency rooms, food safety tests, and law enforcement. DNA collection is actually nothing new, as the Pentagon has admitted that it currently has a DNA database with 80-plus thousand suspected foreign terrorists on it, and of course it's growing daily. However, this collection apparatus has been secretly in place for Americans as well. We only need reference Texas to name just one area where it's becoming known. It's important to note that the technology of tracking, tracing, and databasing innocent people right down to their blood is a top-down directive from federal agencies and not a legitimate scientific endeavor. Legitimate science researches ways to increase human potential and freedom, not use it as a system for identification and control. With the rise of nanotechnology as a federal initiative, we should strongly resist the collection of our life force to be used in any way that government-controlled science sees fit. And you can get more on this story, read back on nanotechnology from ActivistPost.com, as well as 10 ways we're being tracked, traced, and databased. More on the 80-plus thousand DNA database collection from Homeland Security Newswire, the aforementioned TheDaily.com, and you can just go straight to NetBio.com. to read more about their portable DNA scanner to conduct on-site real-time genetic testing. Furthermore, our police state updates, and actually, thanks to the folks at ZeroPointRadio.com for sending me this article from RBR.com, the voice of the broadcasting industry. This isn't a crazy conspiracy site. Radio and Television Business Report. Homeland Security installing transmitters nationwide. RBR, the website we are citing, heard an engineer in a large market had mentioned Homeland Security came to their tower site and put up a building designed as a Faraday cage. They put in a 5-kilowatt transmitter, a generator, etc., but they never told the engineer what they were going to do with it or how they were going to modulate it. Then they left, but they didn't tell him they were going to put these... Oh, well, I misspoke. Then they left, but they did tell him they were going to put these all over the U.S. We spoke to a group engineer on this who mentioned it's likely part of an ongoing project from FEMA, which looks to keep stations on the air with generators in time of crisis. There were recent FEMA and PEP primary entry point meetings going on in D.C. regarding the program. We assume the Faraday cage building protects the new gear and would allow the stations to transmit after an EMP attack or severe solar flare-ups. The group engineer confirmed, quote, FEMA is installing these at all of the primary entry point sites. Now, you should recall, just recently, on this show, as well on NewWorldNextWeek.com, we discussed the upcoming FCC mandate of a nationwide presidential emergency alert test coming sometime this year. The ability for the president to talk to the nation has been in place for decades. However, they've never wanted to use it. However, now they are. They want to set it in place. We've called it the one-button wonder. Sickeningly, jokingly. Because that's all it'll take to override these primary entry point stations. And if you'll recall, those are the main stations. So in the event of emergency, everybody who's not a PEP, who's not a big boy, you pull off the road. They are prepping. Again, whether it's from the sun, an EMP, or if it's a drill gone live, they are testing these systems. They are testing the override of essentially every form of communication. Hence the kill switch discussions. Hence these national presidential emergency alert tests. Hell, didn't we just mention a new national state of emergency with relation to Libya? Needless to say, we are going to cover this story as it develops, as it is of crucial importance to what we're trying to do here. But, of course, I also come from a college radio background, so I, at the very least, find this interesting. And that's putting it very lightly. Interesting, to say the very least. And what we try and do here is not to be fearmongers. We're not on here saying it's all going to go down tomorrow. It's the frog boil, it seems. But there are events that expedite this agenda, these eugenic-obsessed elites, with a great wedding coming in just a few short weeks of the elites. But my friends, we're now into hour number two of episode 208 of Media Monarchy. It's March 4th, 2011, and my name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups, coming to you live from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, and of course, huge thanks, ZeroPointRadio.com, RevereRadio.net, FrOlympia.org, BerkeleyLiberationRadio.net, OneSkyRadio.com, Radio23.org, KBOO.info, all the other great stations who rebroadcast this show, and of course, tragedyandhope.com. You can connect up with me, facebook.com/MediaMonarchy, Twitter, all the others. We can connect and share and grow while this window is open, while we have these amazing tools at our disposal. The rest of our police state updates. External security cameras coming to real-time crime center. That's from standard.net. This coming out of Ogden, Utah. External security cameras coming to real-time crime center. Drones set to invade national and state parks. That's from Danger Room. Meanwhile, KPTV out of Houston. Tiny spy planes could mimic birds and insects. They already are. DARPA's cheetah bot designed to chase human prey. Of course, that's from Danger Room, and is, if you didn't think the big dog robot was scary enough, check out the cheetah bot. Meanwhile, in Gotham, in the Empire State, the Rumbler, the new NYPD siren. You hear it and you feel it. That's from the New York Times, but back here in Portland, Oregon, the Oregonian reporting, Portland cops wrongfully tasering two men, costing our city nearly $140,000 to settle lawsuits. The cops have a pretty quick trigger finger, and it's generally only the difference between which trigger they're pulling, on the taser or on the gun, because they're going to pull one. In a bizarre bit of murder and mayhem, TSA officer kills himself during a shootout, and then the cops almost kill an innocent child.
We have new information about the man who kidnapped his wife and was later involved in a shootout with Santa Fe, with state police, that is, in Santa Fe. We've been following the story since it broke overnight. Police say the man killed himself after firing at an officer. Scotty Schwartz is live in Santa Fe with the new details. Scotty?
I confirmed that the man who killed himself last night after firing at officers was a TSA agent out of Albuquerque. Now, he is 27-year-old Diego Gonzalez. Last night, police say they got a call claiming Gonzalez had kidnapped his estranged wife and their 2-year-old son from Pecos. The woman is 8 months pregnant. State police pulled Gonzalez's truck over on I-25 in Santa Fe near the Cerrillos exit. Investigators say Gonzalez leaned out of the window and started firing at the officer. The officer's patrol car was hit several times, but the officer was not shot. The officer fired back. Shortly after, the woman inside the truck ran out and told the officer that Gonzalez had shot himself.
The officer has to use the amount of force necessary to stop the deadly force action that's coming towards him and the general public. And the driver of the vehicle did display deadly force towards the officer.
Now, earlier today, crime scene investigators marked what looked like a half a dozen bullet holes in the squad car and the truck. Some of those bullets seem to have come through the rear window just above a car seat in the back of the truck. Now, officials with TSA say Gonzalez was a behavior detection officer out of the Albuquerque Sun Port and had worked there for about 4 years. Reporting live from Santa Fe, Gotti Schwartz, KOB Eyewitness News 4.
A behavior detection officer, so we can only speculate what type of training he went through and perhaps what type of situations he was in to result in this terrible scenario. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire, there's a new anti-TSA bill that would make some airport screening sexual assault. That's a crime in this state, and we should charge them every single time, says bill co-sponsor Representative George Lambert of New Hampshire. And George Lambert was a guest on the IntelHub.com radio show. He was on right before me on this past Wednesday's episode. So again, if you subscribe to the feeds, you already got that episode, and perhaps you've already heard about this anti-TSA bill in New Hampshire. Our last note of police state updates posted to the bottom of our DNA genetic pat-down introduced to airports by Homeland Stupidity. A fascinating, interesting story from Jack Blood and Deadline Live.info. in Austin on the 27th of February. For the first time ever, activists were successful in buying trunks full of usable firearms that would have otherwise been destroyed, or of course ended up in the hands of terrorists. As we've seen before, how cops confiscate guns and then resell them to cartels. There is a headline discussing that floating out in the news recently. About 40 gun buyers, both independent and otherwise, stood in front of the Austin Police gun buyback event, offering cash for the guns they were about to turn into the city for food carts. As people rolled up, they approached the folks with the offer and paid them hard cash after inspecting guns to make sure they were operable. And they note the police were unbelievably cooperative in this process. Media was in attendance, both local and international. They did seem somewhat confused by our direct action, as did some of the citizenry trying to turn in their guns. The sound bites on local news all sounded identical. We're turning in our guns so that no one can break in and steal them, using them for crime. Well, the story goes on and discusses, of course, gun laws and the issues surrounding that. But a fascinating move and an amazing success. And that's, again, why we're winning the info war. We now move, my friends, to another nightmarish news purge. That's where we go over all the other subjects and related ephemera as we try and tell you the story of the week here on MediaMonarchy.com. It's the 3-3 News Purge, March 4th to Nightmarica. Of course, referencing our opening track, Nightmarica, from Portland, Oregon's own March 4th marching band. And of course, today is their date. I believe it's their 8th anniversary. And again, as their website notes, it's a date, it's a command, and it's a band. March 4th to Nightmarica. We, of course, begin with our 9/11 updates, and we start with the recently passed Zadroga bill and reporting New York One on the first responders now weighing in on this new 9/11 Health Act.
Former NYPD officer James Ryder says his health went downhill after working for 4 years with contaminated property found at the World Trade Center site.
My health was good. I was jogging, I was running, and things for me started to change. I wasn't sleeping well. I was waking up 70 to 90 times a night.
Ryder, who worked at a peer devoted to establishing a DNA database, says he's been to many doctors who've diagnosed him as suffering from a still unidentifiable heart ailment. He was one of dozens of 9/11 responders and survivors giving their input on how the government should implement the James Zadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act.
For responders and survivors, what they get is monitoring as well as referral treatment.
Among those commenting was Rhonda Villamia, who volunteered at the Trade Center site for 9 months after the attacks.
One of the main things that I'm concerned about is that all of our conditions be tracked. Many in our population are coming up with various conditions that are not on that list.
Anthony Flamia is another former NYPD officer who says he suffers from World Trade Center-related illnesses.
The federal government needs to have somebody looking over their shoulder. They need to be monitored just like we are monitored.
Ann Bauman, whose husband responded for the NYPD, says families of those who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder need help too.
It's like a domino effect, and then as he's traumatized, he brings that trauma into the house, and it goes down the line to your whole family.
The National Institute on Occupational Safety and Health will be taking comments on the program through April 29th. Congress has required it begin to provide benefits starting July 1st. In Manhattan, Roger Clark, New York One.
Meanwhile, another 9/11 firefighter dies of cancer linked to the toxic dust. More on that from CNN. Meanwhile, the aforementioned TSA hit by another scandal as a passenger at JFK boards a plane with three box cutters. Meanwhile, the New York Post reporting FBI finds no credible evidence of 9/11 cell call. And unfortunately, no, that's not referring to the suspicious phone calls allegedly made from and to the planes on the morning of 9/11. This referring to whether or not someone called someone connected to Muhammad Atta. Background on how 9/11 was done from Pack Alert, and going right along with that from Op-Ed News, drugs, bankers, and 9/11, a convergence of convenience. And a flashback And it's posted up on 911blogger.com and also in a better laid out format from 911truthnews.com. The 9/11 omission hearings from September 9th, 2004. Just, I believe, a few short weeks after the release of the official conspiracy theory, the 9/11 Commission report. These videos haven't been seen for a while, but they are all up, and I suppose, in anticipation of his appearance on the upcoming GroundZeroMedia.org episode with Clyde Lewis, Mike Rupert, I watched his half-hour segment on the war games and the drills going on and their connections to Cheney. Our last note is, I guess, just the preface to something we'll mention just a little bit more, but not too much. The Fox News headline, "All hell breaks loose on The View after 9/11 truther cuts loose." And more on that in just a few moments. But let's move to our BioWars EnviroHealth updates. Obama threatens to create billion-dollar drug research center. This is from allgov.com, but they're reporting on the same article we reported to you when it first came out now several weeks ago from the New York Times. Federal research center will help develop medicines. Because they're appalled at the lack of great new Soma pills coming out for the dumbed-down masses. Meanwhile, from STLtoday.com, the FDA pulls 500-plus drugs off the market. So there aren't enough drugs, so we need to speed up the production, but what happens when you speed up the production? You realize that they're not safe and they're killing everybody. Whoops. Again, Daily Mail reporting on Malcolm Cassidaban, now officially called the first U.S. scientist to die of the plague in 50 years. Our flashback to Media Monarchy, September 2009, Chicago family seeks answers in scientists' death by plague. And we also have the video linked up that's on youtube.com/Media Monarchy. Again, from the New York Times, x-rays in unshielded infants raise alarms, and measles attack. Boston, Santa Fe, Denver, and Vancouver.
We want to get to the latest now in a warning about a possible outbreak of measles. Public health officials are concerned hundreds of airline passengers and workers may be infected after coming in contact with an infected woman from New Mexico. Joining us to break this down is CBS News medical correspondent Dr. Jennifer Ashton. So this is a woman who traveled through multiple airports on multiple aircraft, which of course then continue on to other destinations after she is done with them. As a physician this morning, how concerned are you about a potential outbreak?
Well, Erica, there's cause for concern. There's no cause for panic yet. We spoke with an infectious disease expert last night who called measles the most contagious virus there is. So if you talk about the numbers, we know it can have a two-week incubation period, which means you can be exposed and not become sick for 2 weeks. It's spread via airborne particles or direct contact. Those particles can live for 2 hours, and you can be potentially contagious for 9 days. So when you talk about airport travel, wow, that's a lot of potential people.
And those numbers, the fact that it could take so long to develop. The good news in this country is most Americans, a very high number, have been vaccinated. We're told that this woman may have chosen not to be vaccinated. Lay it out for us. What are the real risks here, and what could we be looking at?
So when you talk about the signs of measles, Erica, it typically begins with a fever, and that fever can be quite high. It can be as high as 104 degrees. And then you can get a cough, some red eyes, a runny nose. There's a classic patches that we see in the mouth. And then there's a rash that typically starts on the head and face and work its way down the body. Now, in terms of complications, most of the time this goes away without any treatment, but potentially we can see things like pneumonia and inflammation around the brain called encephalitis or eye problems. Most susceptible are babies who have not been vaccinated, mm-hmm, pregnant women who have not been vaccinated, and anyone with a weakened immune system.
And of course, most importantly, if you think you may have been exposed, go see your doctor.
Absolutely.
Jen, thanks.
Now, longtime listeners know that we cover the biolabs and the creation of the germs and the viruses that ultimately, whoops, accidentally somehow break out in a drill. But I think a way to perfectly illustrate that is the way we'll close out our BioWars EnviroHealth updates with a little bit of audio satire from The Onion.
It's the Onion Radio News, a new technological breakthrough to fix problems caused by a previous breakthrough. This is Doyle Redland reporting. Texas A&M chemists unveiled Zovirex 10 today, a revolutionary new fungicide bioengineered to halt the spread of a fungus unexpectedly spawned by a July 2000 soybean hybrid breakthrough. Project Coordinator Nathan Oberst.
People shouldn't see man-made global disasters as a bad thing. They should see them as scientific breakthroughs waiting to happen.
Oberst downplayed claims that if Zovirex 10 were to seep into the groundwater, it would poison 35% of the human population and destroy all aquatic life, saying that should that happen, the scientific community will think of something. Doyle Redland for The Onion Radio News.
As they are so good at doing... With satire, you can make comments on situations that perhaps you wouldn't otherwise be able to make, or at least as pointedly and cogently as you can right there in 47 seconds. They create the problems to generate the reaction so they can offer the solution. On to our EconoCrash updates. Wars, rumors of wars, skyrocketing oil prices, and the global economic crisis. The EconomicCollapseBlog.com asking, why is all of this happening? And I believe our article earlier from The Independent, in a way, shed some light on that. Food is the gateway issue, if you will. Meanwhile, gold hit a record $1,432.57 an ounce. Meanwhile, China takes a giant step towards making the yuan the world's reserve currency. That's from Washington's blog from Blacklisted News, QE3. Several top feds think more quantitative easing is necessary. Meanwhile, the Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission's frontman, Fareed Zakaria, the expert on all your favorite corporate-controlled news, notes that the U.S. is doomed by their failure to embrace globalism. And I now recall one of the things I was going to mention in regards to the Food Revolution article from The Independent is that they said globalization is a fact. There are no more fire breaks. They mean firewalls. You've heard it referred to as hulls and compartments in a ship. If one gets busted, the whole ship's not going to sink. But now, if we destroy all those other separate areas, it's all going to go down. It's all going to go down when the Titanic invariably hits an iceberg. Just as was warned. Jules Kroll tries his hand at credit ratings. This interesting article that, again, I've mentioned to you a lot that when I'm on break, lunch break at work, I sift through the New York Times and the Oregonian, and I take notes in my little MyPod. Corporate sleuth tries the credit rating field. Few people ever penetrate the dark side of money, but Jules Kroll is one of them, and you better believe it. We don't have time to get into it, but if you have looked into the work of Richard Grove and the story concerning AIG, Kroll and Associates, Marcia McLennan, Skadden Arps, all of the folks that weave around the protection racket, the insurance racket. Meanwhile, former Goldman director charged with insider trading. That's from theglobeandmail.com, and we'll end our EconoCrash updates with an interesting note. As I said, we try and tell you the story of the week. We try and put out interesting memes and connections that we're not here saying everything. Everything is meant to happen. Everything is controlled by the Illuminati. We just sometimes have to shrug our shoulders and say, sinister forces? Crying toddler gets stuck in bank vault. Make your own analogies or allegories. And here we are at the media memes and something we only briefly referenced last week, and isn't it amazing how it's a story that has not gone away, which in all of the cases that we've discussed that in the past, you have to wonder then what isn't being discussed. And that, of course, is winning. The man behind Charlie Sheen's rants, meet syndicated radio host Alex Jones. That's the article from HollywoodReporter.com. Meanwhile, Rolling Stone did a massive piece, The Most Paranoid Man in America, and you must see the painting that they've done with serpents and fire and barbed wire and more. And, of course, the link to the video of Sheen's appearance on the Alex Jones show, which I believe, as we mentioned, he was pretty much the next guest on the next day following our man James Corbett. And it's turned into a huge, massive, ridiculous story, and now he's on Twitter and he's got a million people on there, and we'll reference that at the end of the show. But without weighing into too much of this, it's just, on the one hand, I wonder, wow, are we missing a great opportunity to not be discussing more 9/11 truth, anti-New World Order type of issues now that this is the biggest story out there, or is this just another distraction and people making jokes and comparing the craziness of Sheen to the craziness of Gaddafi, and it's all just a funny show until it hits the point where I'm bored. What else is on? Yes, of course, the Oscars were this past Sunday, and my girlfriend and I actually, over the last few days, watched the downloads of the Grammys from a few weeks ago and the Oscars from this past Sunday. My brief note sidebar on all of this, again, I'm a pop culture junkie pretty much the majority of my life, and I've done a bit of live production in theater, and my girlfriend has done a ton of live audio video production on some pretty amazing shows and shoots. So we enjoy watching these kind of pop culture spectacles and pick it apart from a production standpoint, and I just have to say that the Grammys were a disaster. They looked like a rehearsal. And not as many just bizarre symbols and things in there to watch, and not a whole lot of great things going on there. And as I've joked often, that the Grammys make the Oscars look like the Independent Spirit Awards. But we have the breakdown, if you're interested, from FusedFilm.com on Oscar 2011. On a downward spiral, which is a nice little funny pun to reference the fact that you heard it here first. If I know anything, I know music, and I know what can hit, and I know what should be the single off your record. Trent Reznor won Best Score for Social Network, as we predicted and told you he would and should here on this show, now going back 4-plus months when the film and soundtrack came out. They even opened the Oscars with in the Hall of the Mountain King, the Grieg piece that Reznor does. If you recall, on our Best of the Year mixtape, they started the Oscars with that piece the same exact way I started my mixtape for you at the end of the year. So if I can pat myself on the back about anything, it may not be about my cutting geopolitical analysis, but when it comes to pop culture media, I'm tapped in. Banksy, the most exciting street artist since Basquiat, shows the power of a free market as a peace tool. That is from the aforementioned theintelhub.com. Banksy, and of course Exit Through the Gift Shop, was up for Best Documentary. It did not win, and another one that did not win, and we got pieces from The Examiner and Food Freedom, Why Natural Gas Companies Fear Gasland at the Oscars, and The Examiner notes that Gasland was one of five environmental exposés nominated for an Oscar. However, Inside Job documentary win makes Oscar political statement. And unfortunately, that film Inside Job is not about the official conspiracy theory of 9/11. It is about the controlled demolition of the old financial world order, as the new financial world order is being erected all around us, in just another play of order out of chaos. Meanwhile, the Israeli scientist Natalie Hirschlag commonly referred to as Natalie Portman, is outraged at one of the companies she shills for, that's Dior, and they've fired their head, Galliano, after his alleged "I love Hitler" comments.
John Galliano is out as designer at Dior amidst anti-Semitic remarks that he made in Paris. And one of their endorsers, Natalie Portman, recent Academy Award winner, has come out with her own statement. She's a paid endorser of Dior, but she has come out very strongly condemning Galliano's comments. TJ Walker, is this a risky move on her part to go against someone who she endorses a product for, or great PR all the way on her part?
That was tremendous, tremendous PR. Now, when she made this decision, I guess yesterday, you could make the case it was slightly risky. She could have lost an endorsement, but she comes out smelling like a rose in this. I mean, she gained all the national and international spotlight, winning the Academy Award Sunday night. How does she use this fame? She hops right into a controversy and says, look, I'm Jewish. I don't want to be associated with anybody who says I love Hitler. At that point, when she made that statement, Galliano had not been fired. He had merely been suspended. So she comes out taking somewhat of a risk, showing she's not afraid to stand up for what's right, standing up for her own belief in common decency, her religious principles as well. So she looks like an absolute genius and a saint. Dior, now, after the fact, finally fired him. I think they're going to get some blame for dragging their feet. But Natalie Portman, by being so quick, she gets all this credit now. She waited a few more hours. Galliano's already fired, so it wouldn't have made sense for her to do it. She wouldn't have gotten any credit. Now she gets a lot of credit in the eyes of the public, deservedly so, for having morals, having principles, for standing up for principle and saying, you know what, there are things more important than just endorsement dollars. Now, she also gets our PR play of the day, because at the same time this is happening, there's a gigantic article in the New York Times talking about what a scientific genius she is. While most kids are just trying to get through high school and trying not to flunk out, she was getting straight A's in high school, starring in movies with a widest range of international celebrities, and getting to the finals of the national most prestigious science competition in high school, and studying very, very serious science topics, and when she did go to Harvard, graduating with honors.
So a double standard, perhaps? Some folks, when they speak out, get praised as a genius, and others, when they speak out, are crazy and they get fired. Further down the media memes, Susanna York, star of Tom Jones and They Shoot Horses, Don't They, dead at the age of 72. The one and only Jane Russell passes away at the age of 89. She was the star of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes with Marilyn Monroe and so many other films. She was found dead at her home, and unfortunately that's one of those you hear and you go, yeah, I didn't know she was still alive. You should do some Wikipedia looking and her connections and discovery by Howard Hughes, and how one film reviewer noted on one of her early films that sat on the shelf for a couple of years, some of the effect of her breasts loomed over the film and like a something, you know, they were omnipresent. Meanwhile, from io9.com, artist Jonathan Latham psychoanalyzes They Live, and that is a fascinating piece. And the aforementioned story number 3 from the latest NewWorldNextWeek.com, ideas for a TV show about conspiracy theories, Cryptogon.com posting up his correspondence with the executive producer of a TV show about, quote-unquote, conspiracy theories, asking for show ideas because they're such a fan of Cryptogon. However, after a few exchanges, the executive producer stopped talking. Meanwhile, of course, it's cronies and backslapping, and you'll get a deal, and you'll get a job, and you'll get a contract, and daddy will get this, and you'll get this sweet chief deal. Former Senator Christopher Dodd named the new Motion Picture Association of America chief. More on that from Threat Level on our last media meme note. Another fantastic confrontation. I don't even really like to call them confrontations because it doesn't always have to be that way, and that's not necessarily always the most effective way to go. However, at the CPAC recent conference, interviews and confrontations from We Are Change keep spilling out the latest. James Woolsey denying CIA Mockingbird media control and denying it very weakly. That's W-E-A-K-L-Y. On to the murder and mayhem, unfortunately. And last week, we referenced the widow of murdered CFR MITRE Bush elite insider John P. Wheeler III speaking out on the investigation. She calls it a hit. We didn't have a clip for you last week. This week we do.
The widow of the late Pentagon consultant John Wheeler has made some very provocative claims in the wake of his murder and the discovery of his body on the final day of last year. Action News reporter David Henry has that story.
John Wheeler's widow, Catherine Kleiss, says she thinks he was killed by a professional hitman, and she is blasting the Newark Police Department for its handling of the investigation. Newark police have surveillance video of the former White House and Pentagon aide taken in the hours before he died, but they still don't know who killed John Wheeler or why. Catherine Kleiss is quoted in the online magazine Slate as saying, "They just don't have a clue. I think they wish it would all just go away." Kleiss says after Wheeler's body was found in a landfill, the cops just made our lives miserable. She and Wheeler's children were interviewed by the police, and she says they treated us like criminals, all of us. They were rude. Kleiss says the police confiscated Wheeler's computer and their credit cards. She says since then, someone has used one of her credit cards to buy two airline tickets to Spain for $3,000. As for Wheeler's erratic behavior, Kleiss acknowledges that he was bipolar and had no sense of direction. In one video, Wheeler was seen stumbling through a Wellington parking garage with one shoe in his hand, looking for his car. It was in another garage blocks away. Kleiss says he was disoriented every day of his life. He was probably most definitely lost. Kleiss says she believes her husband was killed by a professional hitman. She says the way they disposed of his body, it's a miracle anybody ever found it. That just sounds like a pro to me. I spoke with Catherine Kleiss by phone, and she says she stands by her statements about the investigation. Newark police administrators have the holiday off, and they've not been available for comment. David Henry, Channel 6, Action News.
So there's the latest we have for you on the story we've been following all year. Another suspicious death. John P. Wheeler III, now his widow, speaking out on the investigation. That coming from WPVI. Furthermore, from Copycat Effect, Allah Akbar, Blackbirds, and Frankfurt. What are we discussing? Frankfurt airport shooting suspect says he acted alone.
A top security official in Germany says the suspect in the slaying of two American airmen has confessed to targeting members of the U.S. military. The two were killed Wednesday, and two others were wounded in a shooting at the airport in Frankfurt. Security officials say the suspect is a 21-year-old ethnic Albanian Muslim who was apparently radicalized over the last few weeks. They also say he acted alone. The suspect's family says they are having a hard time understanding what happened and add they have always had good relations with Americans. German prosecutors and U.S. authorities have taken over the scene and the investigation. They say as of now, they are treating the case as a possible act of Islamic terrorism. Meantime, security has been stepped up at the airport in Frankfurt, with armed policemen in body armor patrolling the terminals. The two wounded Americans are still being treated at a hospital, and the suspect is expected to appear in court later Thursday. Ed Donahue, The Associated Press.
You can check my comment on that YouTube video where I note he must have been reading the ABCs of Jihad, of course, the CIA textbooks. How to radicalize a Muslim. Our last note of murder and mayhem, more on the mayhem side from news.com.au. We referenced last week, of course, Prince Andrew and pedophile Jeffrey Epstein hobnobbing around New York. However, further reporting shows pedophile Epstein flew a then 17-year-old to meet Prince Andrew, and in her story, she goes on to being offered up to all of these men. And that's how it works in these bizarre elite circles. And things connect to the Franklin scandal and, of course, even sex trafficking, human trafficking, and perhaps even mind control and brainwashing. We've heard it referenced before. We're going to hear it referenced again. Completely unrelated segue into our latest Obama-Saya updates. A gay male social secretary for the White House. That's a first. That's coming from the New York Times. Meanwhile, Obama signs the 3-month extension of those key Patriot Act provisions. And, of course, meanwhile, also declaring state of national emergency over Libya. And then Matt Damon tells CNN he's disappointed in Obama. On to our Oregon oddities. Portlandia to help wean Los Angeles from coal. That's from Grist. And our other Oregon oddity note, back to the sex crimes. No parole for former children's home director slash sex abuser. That's from our own KGW. And then it's on to West Virginia Worry. Of course, born and raised West Virginia boy of 28 years. Spent the last nearly six here in Portland, Oregon. Our West Virginia Worry, first from Examiner, as many of these are. West Virginia ranks second in the nation for interstate sales of electricity. Now, doesn't that sound like our first Oregon oddity? Portlandia to help wean Los Angeles from coal. We're selling our electricity to out-of-staters. Further down the Worry, animal fighting is a God-given right. Meanwhile, Spike TV digs West Virginia, set to air reality show on coal starting March 30th. On Coal River documentary making its debut on Mountain State TV. West Virginia's the Mountain State. Massey Energy reaches settlement with a fourth family of a miner killed at the Upper Big Branch mine. You may recall the mining explosion last April, and of course we covered it in great detail. In addition to an interview with Reverend Billy, we even talked to my dad, who was on the scene. West Virginia's workforce at a 16-year low, and unfortunately it seems one of the few growth areas in West Virginia. In addition to the biometrics center there, we also have this. NASA seeks proposals for software verification and validation. This is just a press release on Red Orbit. NASA issued a request for proposals on Wednesday for software services for the agency's independent verification and validation facility in Fairmont, West Virginia. As we'll see all around, the only growth areas are working for the Stasi state. Meanwhile, new senator, former governor of West Virginia, Joe Manchin, returns from a Middle East fact-finding mission. More on that from times-news.com. And our last note from ohmygov.com, naming names, U.S. senators who shun Facebook. And I went over to Joe Manchin's Facebook entry and posted this article, where the last recent thing posted up goes back to November. West Virginia might be the home to the finest coal in the land and the gilded creepiness of the Greenbrier, the former fallout shelter for continuity of shadow government. But good luck finding Senators Joe Manchin or Jay Rockefeller giving constituents updates on the goings-on in Washington or at home. Senator Manchin maintained a fairly active Facebook page during his 2010 Senate campaign, but it hasn't been updated since November of last year. As for Jay Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller IV, he maintains no official Facebook page at all, and of course he's openly mused that perhaps the internet should have never been invented. So the few seven folks who are completely MIA on Facebook is Saxby Shambliss out of Georgia, Jim Risch out of Idaho, Jack Reed out of Rhode Island, Sheldon Whitehouse out of Rhode Island, Maria Cantwell out of Washington, and the other two, Joe Manchin and Jay Rockefeller, out of West Virginia. That ends our West Virginia Worry, and that ends our massive news purge, the 3-3 news purge, March 4th to Nightmarica. We blast through all of those headlines, and again, like so many things, we're just trying to plant seeds and lay out trails, and hopefully you guys will go do more research. The first story we covered on the latest NewWorldNextWeek.com, past medical testing on humans revealed, and as we note at the top, present and future testing on humans still secret. So since you can get the breakdown on that story from the latest NewWorldNextWeek.com, I will leave it right there and we'll just get all the related updates. America's shocking secret, U.S. experimented on disabled citizens and prison inmates. That's again from the Daily Mail. But from naturalnews.com, getting into one angle and one personality in this story, and that's Dr. Jonas Salk, inventor of the polio vaccine, exposed as criminal-minded scientist who conducted illicit medical experiments on mental patients. Isn't it unfortunately disheartening when you find out all those folks that are supposed to be your heroes were eugenics-obsessed, federally funded nuts? like Kinsey and Sanger. But our history mystery updates noted below this, and for a brief moment it was at the top of Google News in an amazingly brief moment. Assassin's lawyer says Sirhan was brainwashed. That's, of course, the one and only William Pepper. Of course, an act of state exposing the false flag murder of Martin Luther King. Of course, an avowed 9/11 truth seeker. And now Sirhan's lawyer. The unfortunate update on this, and the reason this story was burbling up in the news, is now Sirhan denied parole in 1968 RFK killing. Parole officials refused to give Sirhan a date with freedom, saying he hasn't shown sufficient remorse for Senator Robert F. Kennedy's death and doesn't understand the enormity of the assassination that changed U.S. history more than 40 years ago. Sirhan's attorney, William F. Pepper, told the panel he took on Sirhan's case after his former lawyer died, I believe that's Larry Teeter, because he became convinced that Sirhan did not fire the fatal shot. He said he believes a second gunman was involved and that Sirhan may have been brainwashed. There it is again. And we'll note, of course, that the director of the Manchurian Candidate, John Frankenheimer, had a dinner party that night before Bobby was killed, with Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate, and John Frankenheimer drove Bobby to the ambassador where he would be killed by a Manchurian candidate. Meanwhile, answers in 2001 anthrax attacks are still elusive. That's from the Washington Post, and it's pretty much become common accepted knowledge that Bruce Ivins is not the anthrax gunman, and that the anthrax situation is yet another cover-up and false flag attack on the conscious psyche of Americans and all around the world. Remembrances of Deadly Day in 1911, the Triangle Fire in New York's Garment District, remembered with two different documentaries, one on PBS, one on HBO, and interestingly enough, with the sadness and destruction surrounding the New Zealand earthquake, an interesting story, time capsule found in the Christchurch rubble, and it goes back to at least the 1920s, I believe is the latest it could possibly have been put there, and it could be even as old as the 1870s. So we mentioned Changing American History, and that's how we'll close it out with a book review from the New York Times with a few tweaks, Shaking Up History. It's called Then Everything Changed. It's a new book by Jeff Greenfield, the what-if genre of alternative history. And again, that's all posted below Past Medical Testing on Humans Revealed. Finally, my friends, we'll end it. Again, in my home state of West, by God, Virginia, where Frank Buckles, the last known veteran of World War I, died in Charlestown, West Virginia, at the age of 110.
Our nation's last living connection to World War I has now passed. Veteran Frank Buckles passed away yesterday at his home in West Virginia. He's 110 years old, leaving behind a lasting legacy of service to our country. And Steve Santani's live in Washington for more on his life. What a life it was, Steve.
Absolutely, Bill. He lied about his age to get into World War I. He was only 16 and a half, but said he was 18. He later said a boy of that age is not afraid of anything. He just wants to get in there. Now, Buckles served overseas as a driver and warehouse clerk and never saw actual combat action. Later in his life, though, he was working as a civilian in the Philippines and was captured by the Japanese in 1941. He spent more than 3 years in prison camps then. He once said, quote, "I was never actually looking for adventure. It just came to me." Buckles moved to West Virginia in 1954, where he and his wife raised a daughter. His wife, Audrey, died in 1999. Bill?
What is his family saying this morning? Have we heard from them, Steve?
Well, they put out a statement saying Buckles died of natural causes early yesterday morning in Charlestown, West Virginia. The statement says in part, "Buckles was born on February 1, 1901 and has been advocating for a national memorial for World War I in Washington, D.C. and actively pursued his role as the torchbearer for his fellow soldiers from the Great War. To date, neither the Congress nor the Senate has passed the laws that were introduced nearly 2 years ago to get that memorial." Now, Buckles wanted the existing World War I memorial on the National Mall here in Washington Washington to be restored and rededicated as a national memorial to all the veterans who died in that war. No word yet on funeral services for the last known veteran of World War I.
They should do it in his name. Steve Sentani, thank you.
America's last remaining World War I veteran has passed away at age 110.
Frank Buckles enlisted in the Army at the age of 16 and then served as an ambulance driver. He was captured by Japanese forces in the Philippines during World War II. Buckles was held as a prisoner of war for more than 3 years before being freed by U.S. troops.
Buckles was the last of America's doughboys, and Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki called him a, quote, living link to an important era in our nation's history. But the New York Times explains Buckles almost missed his chance at making history. The Marines turned him down as underage and under the required weight. The Navy didn't want him either, saying he had flat feet. But the Army took him in August 1917 when he lied about his age and he volunteered to be an ambulance driver, hearing that was the quickest path to service in France. While Buckles' military service ended after the war, his service to honor those who fought continued. During his life, he actively advocated for a national World War I memorial in the nation's capital.
Buckles wanted the existing World War I memorial on the National Mall here in Washington to be restored and rededicated as a national memorial to all the veterans who died in that war.
Buckles' wish for a national memorial in Washington has yet to come true, but his dream of being buried next to fellow service members and friends will become a reality.
Frank Buckles, the last surviving American to serve in World War I, died this weekend. He was 110 years old. Buckles' biographer says he died Sunday of natural causes at his home in Charleston, West Virginia. More than 4.7 million people joined the U.S. military from 1917 to 1918. As of spring 2007, only three were still alive.
We recognize a group of Americans who served in the Great War and lived to tell of it for the better part of a century. We honor these heroes, and we want to hear their stories.
By the time Buckles was honored at the Pentagon in 2008, the other remaining survivors had died.
As the years went along and the decreasing numbers of veterans, I found that I was among those who had served, the last ones who had served. And it is an honor to be here to represent the veterans of World War I.
Buckles repeatedly tried to enlist in the military, but he was rejected because he was too young. In 1917, he finally convinced an Army recruiter that he was 18, though he was really only 16. Buckles never saw combat, serving in England and France mainly as a driver and a warehouse clerk. During World War II, he was a civilian prisoner of war in the Philippines. Buckles will be buried at Arlington National Cemetery.
A fascinating story to wrap up this show. And it's Charlestown, West Virginia, not Charleston, as that last part incorrectly noted. And that's always something that drives me nuts. And again, being a West Virginia boy and being more of a cheerleader, now being away from the state, is always finding those things with, like, West Virginia is its own state. It's not West Virginia, or Western Virginia, I should say. But what this also reminds me, and again, an interesting, fascinating story. Frank Buckles, it wasn't born in West Virginia, but living there for 50-plus years pretty much makes him a West Virginian as far as I'm concerned. That reminds me, I was watching a documentary streaming on Netflix called Still Bill about Bill Withers, who was born in Slab Fork, West Virginia, and you may know him from his songs like Lean On Me, and Just the Two of Us, and Ain't No Sunshine When She's Gone. And something in that documentary, which I admit I fell asleep during because it was late at night, something in there reminded me of what I had heard earlier that day when I was listening to episode 17 of PeaceRevolution.org about nonviolent communication for everyday situations. Something within Bill Withers and something within myself, seeing that as coming from the same area, and I feel like I've always, for some reason, had some kind of leg up and some kind of extra thing that coming from such a place has given me. So whether my brother can go to Manhattan and be wildly successful, and just as around, you can use those kind of small-town upbringing ideals and even morals and folkways and mores and call them what you want, I think that has helped me survive and thrive as much as I can in the world. So I'll never forsake it, and ultimately I probably will go back to West, by God, Virginia. We're just about at the end of this amazing episode 208 for MediaMonarchy.com. Of course, March 4th, 2011, and we make one last glance back to the breaking news. Libya, fierce day of raids and clashes, signal shift to civil war. California's January unemployment rate falls to 12.4%, and the state of labor, Wisconsin showdown, puts unions back in the national spotlight. But we'll close off with a scroll down our Twitter feed, twitter.com/MediaMonarchy. Longtime listeners now may recall that going back to last fall, I got my very own Wi-Fi pod, and I essentially use it as my music player, my Walkman, if you will, and my Twitter feed. And we're using Twitter as, because really what it is, it's really kind of bizarre. It's almost kind of a celebrity thing. And like I said, Charlie Sheen's on there now. And it's amazing to see and to even interact and try and engage in these weird brief discussions with folks like Patton Oswalt or Doug Benson, but also John Cusack or Jeremy Piven or Charlie Sheen or Morgan Spurlock, the director of Super Size Me from West Virginia. His new movie opens 4/20, and it's called Palm Wonderful Presents The Greatest Movie Ever Sold. It's a film about advertising and product placement made entirely with advertising and product placement. So we're using Twitter, and we're also going through MorganSpurlock.com to do an outreach to try and get an interview with Morgan Spurlock. So if anybody else wants to try and take that on your Twitter feed, please go for it. Some of the things we'll mention on the feed: JP Morgan in talks for Twitter stake. Unfortunately, will they be the next to go down? Al-Qaeda recruiting suicide bombers with promise of halfway decent job in afterlife. That's from The Onion. And as we just said, even people like Jeremy Piven noting last night, is it just me or is there bucket loads of crazy in the air? We can use these tools to outreach and to engage all kinds of folks out there, whether it's your neighbor or whether it's some seemingly untouchable celebrity. The playing fields are being leveled all around on a number of different levels, and there are many, many unfortunate consequences to that. However, there are many, many fortunate and amazing consequences to that that we're only beginning to see and that we're only beginning to try and flesh out. And as they say, my friends, may you live in interesting times. So many things coming soon from MediaMonarchy.com. Please, your support helps keep us going with all the things that we have already been doing, the radio shows and the B-sides and the mixtapes and now even the audio and the video and, of course, the forthcoming NavigatingNetflix.com and all the other avenues. Your support and your help and your involvement is what is going to keep this going and growing, my friends. This has been the 208th episode for MediaMonarchy.com. It's March 4th, 2011. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, reminding you, as always, don't hate the media, become the media. Take care.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRAradio.org, the New World Excellent video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news clips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation or mail media to the Monarchy at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.